that's not the point.
It's on now. What I really wanted to ask you was how you ever got sort of connected with the LSWS or the LNSWS, and how...
Well, so far as I remember, I had nothing to do with them at all until I started my career, and I got into the civil service by taking the exam, which had, papers had come round when I was at college, and the LMH showed them to me, and I was interested. So it was when my appointment to the Administrative Grade was announced that I, my friend was Miss Strachey, I don't now remember, wrote to me and I suppose invited me to.
So you didn't actually take the initiative at all?
Oh, I took no initiative at all. No, I didn't know about it, never heard of it. I'd just come up from Oxford, went into the exam. But I think that the junior council was only just being formed at that stage. And it was the obvious way of joining the London National Society.
Absolutely.
Because I was young.
This was mid-20s, was it? Or late
22.
20s? Yeah, yes. Well, it was... Yes, it was founded, I think, round about 1926.
Well, then I suppose that I must have joined the society and then got myself into the Junior Council when that was formed.
Yes, yes, yes. So, actually, it's interesting because they're clearly broadening themselves out from the rather narrowly feminist organisation into being an organisation for women, you know. And you're presumably an example of a person who wouldn't otherwise have thought of joining them.
Oh, I think this is true. So far as their effect on my career was concerned, there was none. That was settled before I ever heard of them. But what I, thinking it over, if you wrote to me, what I got from them, I think, well, was first of all a welcome into the world of work on a much broader basis than my own little funny office that I went to, which was the Public Record Office, and an introduction to what I regarded then and regard now as a sort of sensible kind of feminism, which was the hangover from the non-violent suffragette days. But this was what they contributed, I think, to my general an approach to the problem of women's employment, which I was experiencing, of course, in my own career, because I went into an office which had never even had a shorthand typist in it before. Mm. Employed no women at all. And it was a very great advantage to me, therefore, to be in contact with the kind of youngish members of different kinds of professions who were in the Junior Council.
Yes, that's interesting. I mean, when you say advantage, what do you mean? Is it partly simply self-confidence? I mean, it's difficult to imagine now what it must have been like when you started off, but did you feel in a sense beleaguered as a woman civil servant, surrounded by men who needed encouragement, so to speak? I mean, was that one of its functions for you?
I suppose it was. I think probably more so when I went from the Public Record Office to the Ministry of Labour, where I was in a very much more robust kind of life from the very odd but certainly very sheltered life in the Public Record Office, which was quite of its own kind. And there, in the Ministry of Labour, that was a very good department for employing women because it had such an experience of it through women in its exchanges. You were still rather an odd person in the administrative grade, and I think what I needed to know, and certainly was helped by the junior council work, was how to comport myself, whether to push my feminism or hold it in the background, which was a thing one didn't know in those days. One started off by thinking that one must pretend that one was in all things rather like a man, and then came round to feeling, well, you were just a person, and if you had a feminine point of view, that was perfectly good and as good as a male point of view as applied to whatever problem you had. That was I think, the pullback that I had from them from an overemphasis on not being a woman, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I do, yes. I mean, how was this done, actually? How did you learn this? Was it just in sort of casual conversation, or was it quite a self-conscious thing? I mean, did you have sort of lectures or talks on this sort of problem?
I don't think so.
It was just sort of you breathed it in.
I think I breathed it in. And I don't have a very clear recollection of what kind of talks we have. I just have a general sense of an organisation which was there to provide information and, in particular, to pat you on the back. And they were very proud of us, and that, I think, had a very considerable effect.
So you sort of sallied forth, in a sense, from the NSWS into your departments, sort of, in a sense, recharged.
I think so. I'm feeling that you were a part of a movement which had done an awful lot in getting the job that you had opened for you, and that you owed a very great deal to the people whom the society represented, who had struggled very hard to get those jobs open. And I think that gave you a sense of responsibility and continuity in a big and very sensibly run movement, because this is my overriding impression of the London National Society, that it was so sensible in its whole feminist approach, feminine approach, I suppose, woman's approach, wasn't. And that it was the sensible kind of feminism. By all means, you had to push in all sorts of directions, rather quietly, sometimes with a bit of a splash, but they were so good at watching what needed to be done and spotting the occasions when you could push. And they go on to this day, and I still get these lists that Mrs. Popplewell now produces of all sorts of statistics and interesting tidbits relating to progress. I mean, I still read this with fascination. I've read them and absorbed that information throughout the years.
In a way, it's rather like the Fabian Societies. It's one of those organisations that are rather characteristically British, aren't they?
In the sense that
they link together newcomers with the established system and show how to manage.
Yes, so, that's exactly what they did.
Yeah.
They were very good at it.
Yeah. It's very interesting. When you said it was an advantage to you, I started off by asking you about whether it was a help in the morale sort of way.
Yes, I think it was.
But was it also a help actually in a rather more narrowly career way? That is, did you meet useful people in inverted commas? And did it perform the function of a sort of club where you made contacts, so to speak, which helped you in your career, either you or other people?
I don't really think it did. I think the contacts I made were the ones I made officially, but I did use it in the course of my Ministry of Labour work in various ways, but not as personal contacts so much as wanting it for official purposes. See, Miss Hilton's Employment Bureau was extraordinarily good. And if I wanted, in my Ministry of Labour capacity, as I sometimes had to deal with women's employment, though by no means exclusively, if I wanted information on the sort of things she knew, I would go to her. If I wanted information, as I sometimes did, about women's organisations, I would go to the London National Society, because they would give me very, very good and accurate information. Miss Dewey was so incredibly good at that and put everything at my disposal. If I wanted to write a paper, as I did sometimes, on women's employment, I'd get a lot of stuff from my own sources, but I would get some more of a less official kind about women's organisations in particular from their library. But I think it was more in that way that I got value than in...
Contact.
I don't know. I suppose just the fact that I knew some of these people through the society meant that it was easier when I wanted official information to get it from somebody I knew. I think this is
And was there a sort of network of women civil servants who knew each other, and I mean, you must know much better than I do in a way, how important these informal contacts are if you're dealing with things of bridge ministries, you know, or...
Yes, but I don't think that I got that from the Junior Council. I don't think so. I think I got that more probably from the Council of Women Civil Servants.
Did you? Yes, I see.
But that was rather an interesting thing. That body, when it had got equal pay and marriage power removed, killed itself quite deliberately because it wasn't necessary anymore. And that is a very unusual thing to happen.
I think
that was partly the result of the general influence of the London National Society because of their sensible approach.
You mean that...
That it killed itself.
You mean that they were very... They weren't vain in the way that independent organisations are. They really assessed themselves.
Yes, what they wanted was to achieve their goal. And when they got it, don't have a feminine body existing just because it always had. That was a very, very great mistake to do that.
Sure, that's right.
And I think that was all linked up with the sensible approach of the London National Society. There were a lot of overlapping membership.
That's interesting, because there was a major conflict, wasn't there, in that organisation between the wars, between the unmarried women who really didn't want married women in the civil service because they'd offer more competition, presumably, to themselves, and the married women who obviously want to be able to continue as civil servants once they get married. I mean, if you look at the debates in Parliament, there's quite a lot of evidence from the representatives of women civil servants against allowing married women.
That was the NOCS, wasn't it? National Society of Women Civil Servants.
Yes.
As distinct from the higher grades.
Yes, yes.
But not within the Council of Women Civil Servants higher grades, I don't think there was that.
No, possibly
that
not.
That difference.
Certainly there's embarrassing sort of evidence quoted in Parliament from women against, you know...
Yes, well, that was the two different organisations. This is, I think, true.
Yes. Anyway, you said... So really, in a sense, you're saying that the NSWS is a useful pressure group, one of many useful pressure groups, which you could draw upon in the Ministry of Labour, like trade unions or other sources of information.
Funnily enough, I hadn't thought of it as a pressure group. Obviously, it was.
It was more of an information agency, you regard it, would you?
Well, I used it more as an information agency, but it was also so objective and sensible. This, I think, was why I jibbed at your pressure group description of it.
Yes.
It always went by assessing facts and applying a sober judgment to them, and certainly it pressed for changes in the law, equality and so on, but I never was terribly involved with that side of its work.
There's another thing, of course, I mean, again, it's difficult for me to imagine, but I imagine that it was difficult for women working at that time because clubs are so important in the male world of politics, and even civil servants, aren't they? And women were excluded from so many clubs at that time. In a way, what the LSWS is trying to do, isn't it, is to provide a sort of woman's equivalent of facilities that men take for granted, as long as women aren't admitted to those men's institutions, if you see what I mean. So it's a place where you can take people for a meal, it's a place where you can read the periodicals, place where you can meet friends or meet business contacts or whatever. And a place possibly even where you can stay for a time. There were rooms there for a time. Did you feel it was important in that way for you as well? It was quite near Westminster, wasn't it, of course, the Women's Service House?
Yes.
And don't let me put words in your mouth. I'm just trying to imagine myself into a situation which is now gone, you know. And I may be getting it wrong.
No, I don't think I used it in that way at all. I went to its meetings. How regularly now, I don't know, just because I found them interesting. But I never made any particular friends through them, or very close official contacts. I think I had sufficient scope after the first 3 years, when really I had no connection with anything except historical research, in which I wasn't interested. That's why I got out. I think my Ministry of Labour life, because the Ministry was such a good department for this sort of thing, provided what was necessary.
I see, yes. So you didn't really feel this need for a club, a woman's club sort of facility?
No.
Mm.
No, I didn't.
Mm.
And I joined fairly early on the, well, I don't know when it was open to women, the Oxford and Cambridge.
That I don't know.
No, but,
yes.
You see, that was a very useful one, because that is a civil servant's retron, and although the women's side is separated, yet there was fairly easy contact. And I don't think I used it in that way. I think very probably it was more valuable to people in some other departments who were more isolated than I was. I wasn't isolated in the Ministry of Labour, but because of its long tradition of employing a lot of women in the inspectorate, and women promoted from the exchanges, and
I see,
this.
Yes. So you feel you might have been unusual among the civil
servants?
I
think probably so. My problems, insofar as they came, were from the work that I was doing, which was of a different kind, because it was administrative and they hadn't had women. Well, they had had some, even on that, because they'd promoted them up from the ranks.
Mm. Well, that's very, very interesting. But what actually then was there physically when you first went there? I mean, what did the junior council offer, really, in the way of facilities or meetings or whatever?
So far as I was concerned, what it offered were occasional meetings where we sat round mostly on the floor, and either Ray Strachey or Philippa Strachey would start up some topic which would then be discussed. We would have cups of coffee and general chat, and there were, I suppose, some lectures, but I have not a very clear recollection beyond these rather amusing discussion parties of various sorts and kinds.
Yes. Can you sort of...
And the occasional use of the library.
Yes, because that was a focus in a way, or becoming a focus, wasn't it, very much. Yeah. Can you recreate Philippa and Ray for me? How did they... If we take Philippa first, she seems to be in a sense of a grey eminence behind all this. I think the junior council was her idea, actually.
I think it was.
But she's a very elusive person. There's no biography of her. There are one or two obituaries and so on. And it's very difficult to quite capture what sort of person she was.
Well, now, Philippa Strachey, well, she was an elusive person. As I remember her, at some of these meetings, she would say not very much, but she would force other people to talk just by shaming them out of it. I mean, you just were pointed at. Now you, there you are, you see. I mean, why not? Ridiculous. She was like a sort of elf, goaded. But she said very little, as I remember her. At Ray Strachey, she said a great deal more. She was much more sort of overflowing. I think we had some meetings when they were either preparing evidence or preparing papers or something, and I think I must have been at to some of those when we discussed what was to go in them, because I have a recollection of Ray Strachey.
Was it probably the Royal Commission on the Civil Service, wasn't it, around about 1930?
Probably was. I think it must have been.
Mm.
And I think they must have called us in to provide information for that. I've forgotten all about it, but I think that must be so.
That rather sort of brings up another question I wanted to ask you, actually, incidentally, while I think of it. You said you had a feeling of obligation to the women who'd opened up these opportunities for you in the civil service and so on. How did that obligation make itself felt in your case? I mean, did it mean that you would respond quite very willingly if they asked you for information, for example, about civil service conditions for women and so on?
Oh, yes, unquestionably. It meant that. And I think it just made me have a feeling that if I didn't do my job well, I was letting them down as well as, well, letting oneself down. I mean, one had one's own pride and one's work, but I think this was a very strong urge to do well, as far as I was concerned, and this was what I got from them and would never have had if it hadn't been for that organisation.
That's very interesting, yes. So they
really... a very strong tradition and sense of responsibility that they conveyed to anybody coming new.
To responsibility, really, to women who might be coming on later and who would need to have a climate prepared for them that would make them very acceptable as employees, really, I suppose. And it's just that, isn't it? Simply... opening up the field even wider by getting a good reputation for women as civil servants.
Well, yes, I suppose so. I wasn't thinking so much of the future ones as of the frightfully hard work that they had done in the past and how they had made it so clear that they believed that women were perfectly capable of doing administrative work and without creating difficulties, that it would have been an awful shame if one had not got on with one's male colleagues, had produced a bad atmosphere, hadn't got promoted when you should and so on, weren't willing to take the kind of responsibilities that were irksome and onerous, like public speaking. Oh, I think I went to one of their public speaking classes. Yes, I did. That was a thing that I didn't find very useful, as a matter of fact, but it was something that they laid on for you and urged you to take. Mm. That was a facility that I had from them that I'd forgotten about.
Yes. Maybe you just absorbed a lot of these things almost unconsciously.
Well, I think so, and that was the value of it, you see.
Yeah. Mm. But with Philippa Strachey goading you to speak, I mean, this is very much characteristic of women in Oxford even now. And if you have a seminar, women don't speak as much as the men do.
No, they don't.
And so you need a bit of a push, and presumably the...
And this is what... Yes, they did.
Yes.
I think without doubt.
Yes, that is very interesting. But getting back to Philippa then, she's a person in the background. But when you say goading, an elf-like... It's not in any sense, it's amusing, isn't it?
Very amusing. Not nagging, in any sense, but needling in a very amusing and sensible way. I went to see her when she was very, very old.
Oh, yes.
And living in a home in Putney only a few years ago. She was just exactly the same and terribly interested still in what had happened to all the individuals she knew. That, of course, was a great feature. You were an individual to Philippa Strachey. More so, I think, than to Ray. I think, in a sense, I would have thought Ray was more interested in movements and principles and strategy and all that than less in individuals. That's the impression I have. I mean,
no, that's absolutely right. That fits with what I've been told. I've spoken actually to Ray's daughter, Mrs. Halpern, and I got a marvellous picture of Ray from her, and that fits exactly with what she's told me. But you see, but I mean, that really does illustrate what you've said, doesn't it? How very important they were as a pair, really.
Yes.
Because they've got complementary qualities, haven't they?
Mm.
So Ray differs then, does she what? In first of all, she talks a lot. She's more extroverted, really, I suppose, is she?
Oh, much more, I think.
Mm.
I always remember a story she told of how she and her husband, at what time, well, I don't know, women's suffrage, I suppose. Anyway, they were in a great state of excitement, and they were busy trying to draft something, and then they were listening to Bates in the house, and they both felt so strong. She was always popping out and being sick, and then coming back and setting to about something else, because she was so overcome by emotion or whatever it was. But that didn't interfere with the fact that she was coming back and doing whatever bit of briefing or redrafting was necessary or something.
She had a sense of humour then, Ray, did she? But quite a different one from...
Yes, I think so, yes. I think she could laugh at herself.
Mm.
But, and she was frightfully enthusiastic. A little overpoweringly so, I think I would feel at times.
Mm. In the sense of being an organiser, you mean? Rather obtrusively organising people or what?
Well, I think probably just going on talking.
Yes. Mm. What did she look like, actually? Because Philippa was rather bird-like.
Oh, Philippa was very bird-like, quick in her movements and bright in her eyes, very bird-like. Ray was much larger and slower in movement, and I have an impression of somebody rather fat, and a full face.
That's right.
And slower in movement, much more massive.
That's right. So really, they between them, they did in fact get on very well together too, didn't they?
Oh, that seemed quite obvious, yes.
Mm.
They certainly did complement each other.
But they really, between them, really make the LNSWS, I think, into something really dynamic in that period.
Oh, I think so, yes. I never thought of... Well, and with Miss Dewey on the reference side, those were the three people who just were it, so far as I was concerned.
Mm. And you say Philippa actually had a personal interest in you. I mean, you really felt that, didn't
Oh,
you?
Yes.
Mm.
I'm sure she gave that impression, and it was a true impression to all the people she was in contact with.
Mm.
But I'm not a very good joiner of women's organisations anyway, and so I never did anything in particular. I don't think I ever sat on its executive committee or anything of that kind.
But you provided them with information when they wanted it or help?
I did, and I went to their meetings. And I supported them in by way of subscriptions and so on. And I used their library on occasions. And I had a great respect for them, but they weren't a... They didn't play a very large part in my official career, and I can't say that I found them useful, particularly as a source of contacts.
Mm. Well, that's very, very helpful, because one doesn't want to overdo the importance of these organisations, and I'm glad you feel able to resist any suggestion that it was over-important. But, I mean, I think it's just a useful thing to have around, really, isn't it?
Oh, it was very useful, particularly, as I say, in the sensibleness of its outlook at that particular stage where women were just going into these jobs. After the war, when they had done all sorts of things by back doors and by hook and by crook, things were settling down into normal methods of entry, and you wanted, I think, this link with what had gone before, knowing why you got into a particular job through a particular opening, and what arguments had been used to get you into it, and therefore what things you had to prove you could do.
Yes, that's... You're telling me just the things I wanted to know. Could I just ask you, about your own family background. I mean, you don't come from a feminist family at all, or you didn't get any feminist ideas from that, did you? I mean, you come to this is your first contact with the women's movement, really, is it? The LNSWS?
I think so, yes. I think my mother was... my mother started a career in the post office, and then she married fairly young, about 28, I suppose, and didn't go on with it. But she came from a Dorsetshire farmer's family and didn't think she could cope with the country life, and she very dashingly came up to town and lived with a cousin and went to work in the post office. So her whole attitude was that why shouldn't women work, but she didn't do anything particular about it, and later on she developed a particular interest in domestic employment, in the sense of realizing that so many people at that time were doing it, and that it needed to be depersonalized and made into much more of a regularized profession. So that bit of background was there, but I think she didn't develop these ideas probably till I was out at work anyway. So there was a general atmosphere of understanding. We were very poor, and it was a considerable struggle to get us both to university, a struggle which my mother most willingly undertook, because she believed in education for women. It was just obvious from the start, from her attitude, from my school's attitude, that a career was the obvious thing. And
so clearly there is a sort of feminist push, in a rather unobtrusive way, from your home background.
Yes, my father died when I was very young, so that he didn't come into it at all, but he was very old-fashioned, the kind of person my mother first married, and she had to go out calling and leaving cards. Well, she was rather nervous, and she hated dogs. She arrived at somebody's house, and a dog rushed out and barked, and as soon as the door was open, she popped in to get out of the reach of the dog. My father was horrified, because she hadn't found whether the lady of the house was at home before she went in. So, my mother had rather severe training.
But your father left her sufficiently provided for, did he, that she could just scrape you into university?
I suppose he did. She had various nervous breakdowns and spent a lot of the money recuperating, so I think she felt an obligation to make up for that. But
what was your father actually, then, Mary?
He suffered a great deal of ill health and a lot of nervous breakdowns. He did not become a minister of the Church of Presbyterian Church of England, as he meant, but he ended up as librarian and bursar of Westminster College, the training college in Cambridge, for a student here.
So he was really, a theologian, was he, or
yes, I think that's what one would call him. He was I think a theologian. He was a German scholar. And his main interest was in the church. But he failed to be a minister because his health broke down.
So then you went, did you go to one of the GPDST schools then?
Yes, I went to, we had a couple of years at the Purse, and then we went to Wimbledon High School.
Oh, did you?
GPD, yeah. Well, of course, your whole atmosphere was, of course you go to college.
Yes, and then where did you go after that? I ought to know, but I've forgotten.
I went to Bedford for a year, which I hated, travelling every day. And then I hated it so much that I decided that something must be done, so I went to Oxford.
And you went to Somerville, did you?
LMH.
LMH, yes, I see. Yes. So presumably you get a sort of... everything would accumulate, wouldn't it, to make you feel you wanted to have a career, really?
Well, it doesn't have...
And you need the money
ever,
anyway. I mean,
nothing else sort of was into God's head. It just was the atmosphere.
Was your mother actually in the woman's suffrage movement at all? Did she support it? Do you remember? I imagine she must.
She was never a suffragette. I'm not sure that she belonged to anything, but she certainly would have supported it in... terms of non-violence.
Yes. But so that really gets you into the whole thing, and then what you really take off once you're in the job. You can make your own way, but everything accumulates to get you there, and then it's your own future, really, helped to a limited extent by the NSWS. Any other organisations really gave you help, do you think, as a woman civil servant, or is it really wrong to think of things in those terms? You're just a person, an ordinary civil servant by that time.
I think the Council of Women Civil Servants higher grades was useful.
Mm.
You certainly met your women colleagues at those meetings.
Could you tell me what it is? You see, I don't know anything about it. I ought to know more than I do.
Well,
about
it doesn't exist now,
mm.
because I say it it finished itself off when it had
mm.
done its job. It just was one of the organisations of women civil servants in the administrative grade, and I forget what others came in, which...
right across the civil service, or
yes.
in every ministry.
Yes, mm-hmm. which duly pursued the aims of equal pay and removal of the marriage bar and anything else that was going at the time, and it went on deputations to ministries to take up individual cases. It would probably push for the War Office to be open to women, and it went on it would give evidence to royal commissions mm. and things on the position of women civil servants.
So it really was a pressure group.
Oh, it was just a pure mm. pressure group,
mm.
and it, I think, was quite sensible in its attitudes, and particularly so when it decided that having won what it needed, there was no point in it any further mm. because it thought that the proper representation of women was through their grade associations,
yes.
and of course it encouraged everybody to belong to the First Division Association, which was the other body that I belonged to, and I suppose mm. found valuable. I think I did. I think I made more useful personal contact that way than through the Junior Council.
Yes. Yes, so there really are a number of organisations, well, there's at least one other organisation that does get women civil servants together and help you to reinforce.
Well, not now.
Not now, but there was.
There was.
Then.
There was at that time, and I think it was perfectly sensible to have it, because there were certain specific questions
yes.
for women. But these were some of the arguments you had in all these bodies. Should you have separate organisations for women? And the answer was, yes, while there are separate disabilities for women, but having got rid of them, no, belong to your grade association and deal with your common grade problems.
Did you just go along as an ordinary member to this organisation, or did you actually hold office in it
no,
or do
anybody.
More than that? So you were simply a backer, so to speak, of it.
Whether I ever sat on its executive for any moment, I don't mm. think so.
Mm.
I think because I always felt very strongly myself that your best way of getting what you wanted was to do the work which proved that obviously these disabilities were a nonsense.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Could we move on just, and you must tell me when you want to go. It's 11 o'clock.
I don't now. Have to now because the chap isn't coming about the boiler till Thursday.
But I just wonder if we could move on a little to the Women's Employment Federation a bit, because you obviously must have had much more contact with that than a lot of women civil servants did. I mean, did it actually impinge on your career in the Ministry of Labour, did it? You needed to have contacts with the Women's Employment Federation, did you?
Yes, I did, for information about the kind of jobs that it filled and about employment prospect. It was very much better, I found, in giving realistic appraisals of employment opportunities for women of that kind than I got from the official Ministry of Labour Exchange Service, just because one of its weakest points was women in the executive kind of jobs that the Women's Employment Federation dealt with. And I always found, therefore, that I got better coordinated information and more effective information from the Women's Employment Federation
really?
Than I always did from my own organisation.
So did the Ministry of Labour actually subscribe to WEF, or...?
No.
It was simply a service that WEF was happy to provide, really, was it?
Well, it wasn't officially linked in any way, and I think my use of it was there. I think you could say that there was a direct effect of having been a member of the Junior Council. I knew about Silton and her Bank Federation, and possibly therefore used it more than I would have done if I had only heard of it as a Ministry of Labour official. I knew it was a good body, and I knew she was a sensible woman, and so I used to talk to her about questions.
I met her, actually, as I told you in my letter.
Yes,
she's retired in Turnham Green, isn't it, I think?
Yes.
And, you know, very interesting person.
Very interesting. I think she did extremely good work.
Yes. But it was in her phase, rather than in Ray Strachey's phase, that you had contact with WEF, wasn't it? Because it was founded in 1935, I think, wasn't it? Or at least it became important in 1935. And under Ray Strachey for the first 4 years. And then Miss Hilton really takes over about 1942 or so.
I suppose it was probably during the war that I had most dealings with it, probably because I was dealing with women's employment then. And I used to meet her at committee meetings and things. The Women's Consultative Committee, of course, was a... Did you know about that, do you?
No. Now, what's that?
Well, that was a Ministry of Labour affair.
No, tell me about that. I don't know.
Oh, well, that was a very useful body. When the war started, Irene Ward and other two other women MPs set up something they called the Woman Power Committee, because they were extremely worried that women weren't being given proper treatment at the beginning of the war, in the sense of being pushed into war work, and employment opportunities for them weren't what they should have been. And when Bevin became Minister of Labour, he saw the point and didn't know anything about the Woman Power Committee as such, but he formed the Women's Consultative Committee, which had the same people on it, plus others. He got the women MPs and women trade unionists, women employers, and all other various people. Whether Miss Hilton was on, I can't remember. Well, that'd be rather nice. Thank you.
Very kind.
And it met regularly, and I think it still exists regularly through the war, with the Parliamentary Secretary in charge. I was its secretary very often. And it was an extremely good body, which kept a watch on all women's questions throughout the war. A very important body. Nice story about Ernest Bevin. Irene Ward regarded it as her committee very much, and then at some point of time she went off it, I can't remember why, and was very anxious to get back on it, and Bevin once said to me, the way Irene Ward talks about the Women's Consultative Committee, you'd think it was the Cabinet. It was really comic. And it went on for years and years, successful if its chairman and its secretary thought it was a valuable body and took trouble to feed it with things, not so successfully if they didn't. But it was always a very sensible body, and I think it was valuable.
And originally created by the woman MPs?
Well, as a Woman Power Committee, it was created by them. Yes. Then it was reformed and turned into an official Ministry of Labour committee by Bevin.
And it's really concerned largely, is it simply with women's jobs and women's employment
women's
in the
employment.
War effort initially?
Well, initially, yes. In war effort, substitution, training. Caroline Hazlett was a great woman on that. Mary Sutherland, Dorothy Elliott. I don't think Miss Hilton was ever on that. I don't think she was. And it's gone on. I mean, a recent member was Diana Rita Harris. It was a very good body indeed, and that produced a lot of contacts for me.
Yes, it's strange. I'm really stopping in my sort of researches, rightly or wrongly, at 1940. So, I mean, I have actually read one or two debates on woman power. There were one or two in the House of Commons.
Initiated by Irene Ward.
Yes. Yeah. Quite interesting debates, actually. But it's interesting to see how these things happen. How did Bevin, I don't know quite what position you by that time reached in the Ministry of Labour. Did you have direct contact with him?
I was an assistant secretary, I think, at that point. Well, one had, from time to time, particularly on women's questions, because I was a senior woman at that stage. And so I used to get hauled in for conferences with Bevin in women's questions in particular.
How did he regard the recruitment of women? I mean, as an old trade unionist, one would have thought perhaps he might have been very suspicious of dilution of any sort, simply because he was Bevin, one would feel there'd be a certain sort of brusque, sort of rough resistance to feminist organisations anyway. But I mean, this may be entirely wrong. How did he regard women's careers and women's positions generally at that time?
I think it was all a part of the dilution which you had. I don't think dilution by women was worse for him than dilution by unskilled and semi-skilled labour generally. These things were preserved to be brought back after the war, but he negotiated all the agreements for dilution. He got his skilled labour inspectors on to analyse jobs and split them down into semi-skilled and so on, and I think the women's problem was just mopped up in all that. My recollection of him was much more. Tape record.
Bevin was like to sort of deal with, really, in the war, particularly
he
related to women's.
Was incredibly practical.
Was he?
You see, he knew what it was to run a big organisation because he ran the Transport and General Workers Union. So he knew how to run the Ministry of Labour, as no other minister ever has, because he knew exactly how to get what he wanted across, because he was used to doing it. And he would check up on what the Ministry of Labour told him from what his Transport and General Workers Union branch was saying. My people tell me, Bevin would say. But his approach, well, he one aspect of it was, I think, very interesting. He was very chary indeed of applying powers of direction to women, and rightly, in many ways. He wouldn't have it, no powers of direction to a married woman to go away from home. Well, that was right enough. But he did that because he knew that nothing would upset the troops more than feel that their wives might be sent away. No direction to a woman until her case had been to an informal advisory body consisting of women to see whether it was sensible to get her to move, get her to take a job. Very stringent training and instructions to women officers, because he had an extremely close understanding of what the reaction of the husbands was to mucking about with their wives. Single women, yes, they got to be sent away from home, but extreme stress on their welfare arrangements. Almost practical. But one bit where I disagreed with him was that he was too reluctant to issue instructions, directions to women, particularly married women, who used to come along and say, if you just give me a direction, then my husband can't say anything about it, but it's too much to expect me to convince my husband that I'm voluntarily going to do part-time work and not be there to cook his dinner. If I've got a direction, that's all right. I couldn't get that across to Bevin. But he was too chary about this, and he thought I was very hard. She's hard, that woman.
But how did he behave to you as a woman civil servant? I mean, did he treated you just as any other
civil servant? Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I mean, there was no fuss?
No fuss at all, none. I think he was used to his women trade unionists. No, he was just such a straightforward, ordinary, sort of honest person.
It's very interesting. Very interesting. I mean, of course, you know, he has a double expertise there, doesn't he? I mean, A, as a trade unionist, and B, as the manager of an organisation. I mean, he's got both qualities. I mean,
yes.
Unbeatable in a way. But nonetheless, it was always regarded as surprising that he was such a good foreign secretary later, wasn't it? But in fact, I mean, presumably the same things apply in a rather different way. That is, it's another big organisation to run, and secondly, you're dealing with power politics, and he's used, as a trade unionist, to dealing with clashes of interest.
And he was used to negotiation.
Yes, absolutely, yes, yes. But, of course, the more left-wing sort of interpreter of Bevin would say, well, of course he got on with his civil servants because he just did what civil servants wanted.
Oh!
But what would you say to that? I mean, in
oh,
your experience?
Not in the least. He was, just because he knew what he wanted and how to run a big organisation, he was more in charge of the ministry than any other minister. Absolute nonsense.
Mm. So there's no question of his being captured by the civil service at all?
Absolutely none. He started off with the usual doubts, and he brought in labour supply advisers and industrialists and trade unionists in the way that governments are now doing. But they faded out as he got accustomed to sort of his civil servants and knew that they did what he wanted. And so the relationship was extremely happy once he got used to it, but he did start, unquestionably, with feeling of what could a civil servant know about industry? What, how could you possibly say that? He had a trade unionist and he had an employer and he had various people.
But he could learn from experience and realise that these fears were unnecessary.
But yes. I think he still kept a certain number of... I mean, he had Caroline Hassett as a train advisor on women's training employment, though I rather think that was because it was a good thing to have, obviously, a woman in that job rather than that she was absolutely essential for the work. That may be a civil servant prejudice, I don't know. Yeah. She was good, but she was more important as a publicist than she was as advising on training, I think.
Yes, I've come across her at various points, and she is a former suffragette, or is, isn't she? I can't remember
yes,
what
I
she was.
Think.
Yes. She was another person who's a bit overpowering, wasn't she?
Yes.
Can you describe her to me as you knew her? I mean...
She had a most astonishing capacity for combining all of her various activities in such a way that each one supported the other. She had the Electrical Association for Women, and she was president of the Women's Engineering Society, and she was international president of the Women's for Optimists, and international, well, I forget, all these sort of things. And in one capacity, she helped the other. She was a wonderful publicist, not merely for herself, though that came into it, but for all these organisations. She was absolutely first class. And because she was sensible and pleasant and amusing, she went down very well with her male colleagues, and I think she was able to do a very great deal for pushing women in the technical sphere. We all felt it was just slightly bogus, but it was very effective.
How do you mean slightly bogus? You mean that she didn't really have much expert knowledge, or what?
Yes, she always claimed to be an engineer, but we all sort of thought it was really rather on the basis of a couple of years at the bench in a rather half-hearted fashion, but it didn't matter very much,
no,
because she was never doing anything technical, but she did give very sensible advice, and she was able to persuade people about women. I don't know whether you've ever read her sister's life of her.
No, I haven't. It's
an appalling book.
Is it really?
I mean, Caroline won the war single-handed. That's what comes out of that book. And it's really a shame to have had a book like that written, but she did very much more than that.
What exactly was her achievement then, do you think, scaling it down to proper size?
In the war? Oh, I think she did do a great deal to push women in technical jobs. I think there's no doubt she sat on the right bodies, she knew the right people, she could put over her facts very well. She was attached to the Ministry of Labour as advisor on women's training, she was running the Women's Engineering Society, she was a very good publicist, and I think she did a very considerable amount for opening opportunities for women when she was the member of the electrical board, whatever it was, I can't remember. I think she got apprenticeships open to women, and she was very good making speeches in the right time, in the right place, and I think she did a lot.
Mm. And how was this done? Just with great energy, self-confidence?
Great energy, great self-confidence, and a wonderful fair flair for publicity, for what she was doing combined with Caroline Hess's, undoubtedly, but that didn't matter.
No, no, I mean, one's own career can be promoted to, yes, in the general interest, yes, as well, can't it?
And yeah, she was a very good internationalist, too.
Well, that is most interesting. But I hadn't realised you'd come across her.
Oh, yes, a lot. Because she was always at the Women's Consultative Committee.
Yeah.
And she was...
What sort of positions did you occupy then in the Ministry of Labour? You started off, you were all in the Ministry of Grade throughout, of course, weren't you?
Yes.
But what roles did you, what positions did you occupy?
Up to
about 1945.
Any more tea?
No more, thank you, no.
Up to about 1945?
Hmm.
Well, I went through the ordinary run-of-the-mill stuff. I was in establishments. I was in the nearly always on the employment side. I started as an assistant principal in one of the employment departments. Then I was promoted principal, went to establishments. Then I think back to the employment exchanges. I never had anything to do with unemployment insurance. Then in 1938, I was shot off to work for 2 years with the WBS. I started that up with Lady Reading. In 1940, I went back to the ministry and went straight into the new welfare department, which Bevan had set up in order to look after the welfare of men and women who were being transferred about the country. Then I went back to the employment department and looked after the civilian employment of men and women. I had nothing to call up to the army, and I wasn't on the skilled manpower side, but I was doing all the straightforward work of call up of women and call up of men for industrial employment.
Mm.
Then I had all the questions of control of labour, use of directions, central work orders, all that side, as I was promoted to assistant secretary. That's when I mostly met with Bevan.
Mm.
I did quite a bit of broadcasting on women's questions.
Did you really? All that, yeah. Did you really? Yes. How was...
Once had a dialogue with Eleanor Rathbone.
Did you really? Mm. Did you really? On the radio?
Yes.
Did you really?
Got a picture of it.
That's very interesting, because she's a remarkable person.
Oh, she was a grand old girl, yes.
Very remarkable.
I can't remember what we were talking about, but it was...
Family, it wouldn't be family allowances, would it?
I think it was probably more about child care.
Because
I got involved in that too.
Yeah.
Nurseries for war workers, babies and all that.
Could I ask you lastly about the women's WBS thing? I did want to ask you about that because Miss Halpin mentioned it, and also it's a rather important moment, isn't it, in women's organisations, really. The WBS is probably the best known of all women's organisations, isn't it, in English history, really. I mean,
I don't know about women's institutes. Are pretty
Women's institutes are quite well known in the countryside, that's true, yes. How did you get involved with that, and why were you chosen to
that? I was Lady Reading. Why, I don't know. She happened to have met me. I didn't even remember that I ever saw her, but she just said she thought I was the right person, so she asked the ministry and they said no, so she finally rang up the minister when he got flu and bullied him such an extent that he said yes, told the department, and that was that. I was just
trying to think which minister it would be.
Ernest Brown.
Oh yes.
And he just assigned me there, kicked it against my will, but there it was. And
this was simply to set up the WVS, really, was it?
Yes.
And you were... what was your role exactly? Simply channeling government money, was it?
No, I was the general secretary. I was there to see that it kept on the right lines. No, the money, thank heaven, Lady Reading was very good about that. I didn't see how we could possibly run our own money. It was meant accounting, heaven knows what. So the Home Office did all the supply of services. We never touched a penny, thank heaven. They provided the one or two shorthand typists, and the rest was a case of organising the voluntary labour.
And so when you say you were there to keep it on the right lines, what were the right lines, actually, then?
The main one was that it was concerned with civil defence, and since civil defence was the responsibility of the local authorities, you had to ensure that anything the WVS did was done at the request of, with the approval of the local authorities. And it set up its organisation throughout the country on that basis. And there again, Lady Reading was very good. She never let it deviate from that. I mean, she'd take every possible step to see that the local authorities asked for what she wanted them to do, but that was absolutely firm and fixed. And if the WVS was doing as it did, training for all sorts of different kinds of rather unofficial civil defence work, that was done to approved Home Office standards insofar as they existed. It just had to be kept on those lines, and as they had all their postage franked and all the letter paper headed, provided and everything, I had to see that whatever letters were sent out made sense in terms of government policy and weren't just frivolous or committing the organisation to something that was contrary to government civil defence policy.
Why didn't it actually attract you being drafted to do this? I suppose you just didn't envisage at first what an important organisation it was going to become.
Well, I was deeply interested in what I was doing. I hadn't the slightest desire to be taken off it. I had no idea what this body was like. I didn't even know Lady Reading. I hadn't a clue as to what it would be about. In retrospect, of course, I'm extremely glad I did it because it was very, very valuable experience.
Very broadening, I imagine.
Very broadening, and it was a piece of responsibility where you had nobody, practically speaking, to help you. And I was there to keep Lady Reading in order. And she was very good about it. I said at the beginning that I must, if necessary, go over her head or behind her back or whatever if I thought she was doing wrong to the Home Office. And she said, of course, no question, you must. And I never had to, as it happened, because she was very sensible, though very authoritarian.
Yes, that's one thing one or two people have said to me. You see, in a way, the WVS isn't really in the main line of feminist organisations, is it?
Because not at all.
They were all very democratic in their structure, whereas WVS is, as you say, authoritarian, really. Well, you actually have directives sent down, don't you? I mean, the word is used, isn't it? Which, you know, being conceivable in the old NUWSS or even the LSWS, really, or any voluntary or general voluntary.
Oh, quite different. Mm. It had no constitution. It had a framework, an organisation, which Lady Reading set up. She had her regional organisation, and she had regular monthly meetings with her regional organisers and regional administrators. And she was incredibly clever because she was always travelling and she was always talking to people. And so she always knew much better than anybody else what the feeling was, and she was very quick at seeing that stresses and strains here must be changed. But it was never done by any possible democratic means.
Mm.
None at all. And of course she never had to bother about money.
No.
Home Office prize. And the other women's organisations, very dubious. This new body with government backing.
Well, I believe the Tasmanian Guilds weren't they? I mean, they were one of the organisations that was very suspicious.
So were the Women's Institutes and the National Council of Women. Lady Reading collected an advisory council, so-called, which all these women's organisations met once a month to discuss, I don't know what exactly, common problems. That was the one meeting she was frightened of.
Because people wouldn't just do what she wanted, you mean?
Well, it didn't matter whether they did what she wanted or not, because they were separate bodies, but they were critical.
Mm.
I don't really think that advisory council had any particular purpose at all, but I think she thought it was valuable to keep them feeling informed and consulted.
So in a way, you must have felt a bit torn on this, wasn't you? Because you know the whole climate of the women's voluntary organisations, but you also see the government side of things.
Well, it didn't matter because it was war, you see. It was just about going through wartime, and things had to be done. And Lady Reading tried to get the Women's Institutes to undertake the responsibility for receiving evacuees insofar as voluntary agents were concerned. And the Women's Institute said, I'm awfully sorry, we cannot give an undertaking until we've had an annual general meeting in the Albert Hall. Well, there wasn't time. So Lady Reading said, all right, the WVS will do it. Well, the Women's Institute didn't like it, but it couldn't work. This was why I didn't mind. It was something that had to be done with efficiency in the wartime, one tried to keep it as sweet as possible with the other organisations, but they weren't geared to it.
Mm. In a way, democracy only works within rather severe limits in wartime, doesn't it?
It does, and this was...
But do you feel that Lady Reading's, I think you used the word authoritarian personality, was that very suited to the organisation, actually? I mean, it required an authoritarian person, the WBS, did it?
Well, with the jobs it had to do, yes, I think it did. But her authoritarianism was concealed by her incredible capacity for getting people to do what she wanted through her own personal qualities of charm. So I don't think anybody terribly bothered about that who were in the organisation, because what she did was to provide a means by which women who could only give part-time service could find a way of doing national service. She cashed in on that, which was the purpose of the organisation after all.
Mm.
And so the general feeling was, well, thank goodness at least we can get something that we can do.
Mm.
And she gave them training and she thought up jobs. Civil Defence was very interesting. The Home Office put out great pamphlets saying that such and such an organisation was needed for the warden service, and you wanted so many wardens for such and such population, of course it would be necessary to have support in the way of canteen services and this, that and the other. Lady Reading took all these yellow books and sat us down and said, now work out how many women you want to provide these ancillary services that are developed in two or three words in an addition, just as an appendix to the yellow books. We did this. We produced a wonderful total, which of course no one ever thought of, and showed it to the Home Office, who really had fits and said, where do you get this from? So we said, this is where we get it, you see. This is the yardstick developed from your own publications, but you haven't thought of it in terms of women. This was where Lady Reading was so clever, and then proceeded to work out some very sensible instructions for training you'd need and put it out to local authorities and said, we will provide this, that and the other. This was the way she worked. She was very clever.
She was very
clever.
Practical, you mean?
She was very practical.
Mm.
Very far-seeing.
Mm. Mm. Are you actually going to contribute an essay on her to this book that's being planned?
I've done it and I've sent it. I refuse to give it to the WBS. I saw no reason why they should have copyright in what is a contribution to Lady Reading as a person, not as a WBS. So I sent it to the Fawcett Library and said, you are the proper place to keep this kind of record.
That's splendid. So in fact, I could read it there.
Yes.
Oh, that's very useful. Because I think Mrs. Halpin is editing a book or something, isn't she?
I don't know. Lady Pike told me that they were thinking of putting together a collection of the most interesting of the contributions that they have collected about Lady Reading, because they very sensibly be doing that, but I didn't agree with the fact that it became their property. I thought that was wrong, in principle. Because they might refuse some bit to somebody because they didn't happen to think that it reflected fairly on the WVS. I mean, that was always a possibility, not that I think that Lady Pike would do so, but it seemed to me there's a risk in giving your copyright to that organisation. So I jibbed and sent it to Fawcett Society.
Well, that's very useful. So, I mean, there's no restriction on reading it. I mean, I could read it there.
Well, I've handed it over to them and said, you apply whatever rules you think sensible.
Oh, marvellous. I will go. In fact, I'm going to go there later today because I've borrowed some books from Father when I asked them. But what did you actually have to do? I mean, I see your responsibility, but I mean, how did you spend your time setting up?
Well, organising the office. And Lady Reading started with one room in the Home Office and one, her own personal secretary and one other woman. And then I joined them and we had to recruit a headquarters staff, move into headquarters offices, arrange with the Home Office for the supply of services and materials and typewriters and telephones. Cope with the floods of volunteers that poured in. Well, we had first of all to agree on the kind of publicity that was going out. Then Lady Reading held a press conference. The result of that were floods and floods and floods of letters from all over the country with no preparation to deal with them. I hadn't realised what would happen. We couldn't even open the ordinary post because it was covered up in 500-600 letters a day. So we had to organise volunteers to open the envelopes. Lady Reading arrived on a Saturday morning and issued all sorts of instructions for 15 typewriters and I don't know what all, and I waited till she'd gone, and then I read some of the letters myself and drafted stock replies, got the volunteers to get them into various heaps, and we went on from there. And then we had just to organise the regions. How were we going to organise the country? What kind of training schemes were going to be started? What information was going to be given to the local authorities about the existence of the WVS? We had to draft a circular which the Home Office would send out to local authorities explaining who we were and what we were. And then Lady Reading would go to great meetings which had to be organised in different parts of the country and start up a centre, which promptly meant that they'd got to be supplied with stationery and so on, because which meant we had to have our own store, because if the Home Office did it, it would take 6 weeks, by which time all the enthusiasm had evaporated. Mm. And just had to organise a registry. I actually had a couple of good Ministry of Labour trained girls to do that, to explain to the staff what a registry was, how they got their letters posted. They used to have to go down every evening before the mail went off, just read the letters to see whether they made sense or whether they didn't. Hold back the ones that didn't, explain the next morning that their letter hadn't gone because it wasn't in accordance with policy. Oh, just general dog's body and running the office.
So
eventually, of course, it got into proper shape. And
so once you set it up, you moved back.
After 2 years, I moved back. Yes. Mm.
But just to understand your position, are you in a sense then Lady Reading's head of the administration?
Mm. That's general secretary, I'm not.
Yes, I see.
Yes, I was. Ran the administration.
Mm. Which presumably grew tremendously fast as it got launched, didn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. She started up very quickly, and with regional. As soon as the war started, she sent out senior people to each region. We had a regional office and centres in every local authority area, and a regional department at headquarters, all staffed by volunteers with a few. Paid, one paid person in each region, and a few paid shorthand typists, and telephone operators, but all the rest was voluntary.
Where was headquarters then? In the
Tothill Street.
In the Home Office?
No, in offices in Tothill Street.
Oh, I see.
It was paid for by the Home Office and provided by the government.
And presumably they just grew, did they? I mean, you presumably started off with sort of three
rooms.
Yes,
we grew rapidly.
Yes. Because it's difficult, as I say, I don't think you can really fit that organisation into preceding women's organisations at all. It just springs out of the ground.
And it was an arm of the Home Office.
Yes. Mm. And you would presumably just get recruits on a voluntary basis, would you? I mean, that is, you wouldn't approach women's organisations to say, get us some people.
Well, that was one of the things that Lady Reading tried to do. But the women's organisations very naturally said, if you can provide jobs that as an organisation we can do, that's one thing, but we're not going to help you pinch all our members. This was one of the troubles of the Women's Institutes and Towns Women's Guilds and so on, and the Girl Guides and all that. They didn't want to have their members pinched.
And women's organisations' attitudes to it. I mean, they were frightened of their recruits being pinched, weren't they? So you actually had to go out direct direct to individuals.
Yes. Oh, I think this was essential. I don't think it really would have made sense to try and do. Though, of course, you had to do a lot of cooperation with things like the Red Cross and St John's, because they were doing a lot of training, and the WVS worked in with them, and that, of course, was a perfectly sensible plan. And in some areas, a local women's institute would just take on. It would decide it would do it, and that's how it worked. And locally, I think there was a great deal of very sensible cooperation between women's organisations, and some of them would take over a particular job by arrangement, and that was...
So really, perhaps one ought not to judge the relationship between the Women's Institutes and the WVS by what happens at the national level.
Not entirely, by any manner of means. You must also look at the local level.
Yes, that's
but the government did have to have an undertaking that somebody would see that there was a group of volunteers to cope with the problems of evacuation of children, and the WBS undertook it. How it was done locally was different, but there were evacuation representatives appointed throughout the country, and it was done to some extent in cooperation with national organisations, because in that emergency they did see that something had to be done, and they would say, well, our Mrs. So-and-so is a very good person, and it might well be that the president of the Women's Institute would be the person designated to do this locally, and probably the WIs ran it in that particular place. That's sort of way it worked on the ground.
Yes, that's very interesting. It must have been a rather exciting time, really. I mean, does it seem to you almost a climactic in your life, that 2 years? I mean, it must have been very sort of dramatic
well,
in some ways.
Yes, the United Nations was more so.
Yes.
But funnily enough, the WBS experience was what stood me in best stead for coping with the UN, because it was the beginning of two organisations.
You mean just getting something launched, you mean? Yes.
I went out as director of personnel at the beginning of the UN, and that was improvising from scratch too.
Yes, so it really was a good president.
It was very good president, and I made a lot of friends in WBS, and Lady Reading was a very stimulating person.
Mm. Yes, was she, in relation to individuals? I mean, she was a person it was easy to get on with, was it, as an individual?
Well, that depended on you. She had an absolute fascination for an enormous number of people. I made Jane my... She liked to dominate them. And not offensively way, but I think she gained a great deal of energy from her association with people. And she did like to involve herself in their personal life. Well, that she never got from me. And so we had a bit of a unrecognized struggle at the beginning. And then she dropped it and we had a very happy official relation. But she certainly had a very great fascination.
Mm.
And people always felt that they were most important to her. Mm. And she played all the usual tricks. Well, obviously that's all set out in my document.
Yes, I'll certainly read that. I mean, the other thing I want to ask you was simply really what it was like coming out of the Ministry of Labour into an organisation which really throve on voluntary bodies and voluntary work. I mean, did it seem to you a very unfamiliar atmosphere to work with? Because
it entirely depended whether the individual volunteers had worked before or whether they hadn't. If they had, it was perfectly straightforward. If they'd never had the discipline of work, it was very difficult. They hadn't... if they had a hair appointment, they went to it and left a little note, undated and unsigned, saying, shall be back at 5 p.m, have gone to the hairdresser. That sort of thing. But that changed as people developed the habit of work.
Mm. Did you actually find that you discovered, so to speak, hidden talents or hidden organisational ability or whatever in a lot of women who'd never actually been involved in organisations at all? Or was it really the organisation women who just come in and take it over as they had been beforehand in other organisations? I suppose it's difficult to say.
It's very difficult to say. I think it was obviously a mixture.
Mm-hmm.
Some people did develop extraordinarily good capacity, but a great many of them had worked before their marriage.
Because Miss Halkin had been, chairwoman or whatever of the junior council, actually. And so she sort of has an organisation experience beforehand.
Yes, and she'd been working for a living. It was it was the fact of having worked and understanding the obligations of work and time and method that was the most important thing.
And also, surely, I don't know, but I imagine just being able to work with other people. I mean, that's also something that you have to learn, really, don't you? Rather than getting your way the whole time, having to compromise and having to work in a committee and also not speak when somebody else is speaking and this sort of thing. All that has to be trained, really, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I don't remember that difficulty. I remember more difficulties, as far as I was concerned, in getting method into the office working on that side of it, and people didn't understand about dating and signing things or keeping carbon copies or putting things in files or seeing what the previous correspondent was. This sort of thing was a terrible job to get organised, but eventually, of course, was. And this is where Lady Reading was very good. She had worked as a secretary herself, and she knew the importance of proper filing. She backed up all necessary steps.
What about her inspiration? I mean, where did the drive come from in her own case? Was she an ambitious woman, do you think? Or was it extreme patriotism that influenced her? Or was it a sort of zest for work? I mean...
Yes, I think it was a zest for work.
Hmm.
She had run the Personal Service League before she came to the WBS, just because I think she did have a great capacity and wanted to use it. And I think the death of her husband had left such a blank that she needed to fill that. And I think she very much needed contact with people to charge her batteries. She throve on it.
Yes.
Would have exhausted most people, but it didn't exhaust her.
I must read your memoirs. There's no point in asking to repeat it now. Is there anything else you really think it's important to say? I mean, in terms of your own career, about women's organisations or the relative importance of different organisations? I mean, you've given us a marvellous picture of a whole range of bodies, really, which I hadn't quite realised how wide your range was. Is there anything you think I haven't that's really important in the advancement of women that you came across in your career that I haven't asked you about? Or that I just wouldn't like to sort of miss something you thought was important before I switch off.
Well, I suppose there is this question which I only partially met over the Women's Civil Servants Unions, of how far it is reasonable for women doctors, women solicitors, women lawyers, what have you, to form a feminine association. I think it probably was, but I'm very doubtful about the sense or viability of any of them now, women architects and so on. I don't know how many still exist, but I should hope they would have dissolve themselves.
So you really think that women's organisations in many respects are a sort of temporary thing that's necessary to eliminate certain attitudes or...
Well, to eliminate certain attitudes and induce certain attitudes. I still think you have a need for organisations to go on pushing. I mean, I don't like Women's Lib, but I think you do still have things. But I can't really see that once you have eliminated difficulties and got equalities and things, that you need to go on associating professionally as women. And I don't know whether that's generally agreed or not, but I think that is my view. I think it's a mistake.
I think that's right, thank you.
But I think it's something that would be interesting to know whether it has happened.
I went to talk to Baroness Wootton about her career, because she's had a very interesting career in some aspects of the women's movement. They're not all of them. She said how, for instance, I think somebody had asked her to join a thing called Women Against the Common Market. And she said, well, women haven't got any distinctive view about, you know, whether we should go in the common market or stay out of it. They're no different from men in regard to that. There's no point in having a distinct organisation at all. And she also now said she reacts against the idea of having statutory women as well. I mean, she thinks that women should be included in commissions or whatever it is on their qualifications.
Well, now this is a very important point on which I think the Women's the Fawcett Society is usually very sensible, but it's a very, very awkward one that I've never got straight in my own mind. I agree entirely with Lady Wootton in theory, in principle, but it is that you put your woman in if she merits it in respect of whatever the thing is about. But I'm not sure that we have yet got to the stage where that does happen automatically to a satisfactory degree, because we haven't yet had enough women taking advantage of the equal opportunities to get to the position where it does automatically happen. And so I think you have still got to steer this very awkward course of pushing the claims of a woman who can do the job but who doesn't automatically come to the fore, partly because of prejudice still, which is just one justification for doing it, and partly because they haven't yet had the experience. And yet it is true, I think, that it's valuable to have a woman's outlook, which does to some extent differ on these various these boards. I was just thinking the other day, I happened to have had an accident to my leg, and I had a woman surgeon. I just picked up as a casualty, and there it was, and she operated, and as a result, she's looked after it ever since. Well, I have a woman doctor myself. It isn't because she's a woman in a feminist sense that it gives me pleasure to have had her, but because a woman doctor is so much more practical in the follow-up afterwards. A man surgeon will wave his hand, as the man professor who came round did, and said, "Oh yes, yes. Well, of course you can walk about as much as you like. Just put it up when you're not being active." The woman surgeon said to me, "Look here, this has got to heal. It'll heal very much better if you keep your leg up just as much as you possibly can and walk about in between times when you must to." And she gave me most precise directions as to what I was to do. Well, it's that perfectly different, perfectly sensible contribution that in that very small sphere I think you get from a different approach of the sexes. And that's just an indication of why it is still sensible to say, yes, it is a good plan to have a woman.
Yes. Well, let's leave it at that.